Today Break Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti, Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Humanitarians ask who bombed a hospital in Gaza.
Israel knows where all the hospitals in the Gaza Strip are. This was not an accident. I'm sure this was targeted and on purpose.
The U.S. says it doesn't know who was behind the explosion at the Al-Adli Arab Hospital. Gaza families are trapped outside their homes as they try to survive airstrikes. Kenya's President William Ruto seeks $1 billion more in loans from China. The chair of Liberia's Elections Commission is content that the commission conducted the October 10th polls with integrity and credibility.
We have announced results to the effect that just a few polling places are left, and we'd like to believe that in another few days' time we should be able to announce the final results of these elections.
And ICRC says extensive humanitarian needs remain unfulfilled in Sudan. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Local authorities in Gaza say an Israeli airstrike killed hundreds of people at a Gaza City hospital packed with dozens of wounded people and other civilians seeking shelter on Tuesday. The United Nations says an Israeli airstrike also hit one of its schools that was being used as shelter. Robert McCall is the Director of Government Affairs for the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He tells viewers Carol Van Dam the Israeli strike endangering civilians was intentional.
We're hearing exactly that from Palestinian organizations and members of the Muslim community that are reaching out to CARE. We're instructing them, like CARE's done, to condemn this as just the latest war crime by Israel in Gaza. This has killed hundreds of people in a hospital. Israel knows where all the hospitals in the Gaza Strip are. This was not an accident. I'm sure this was targeted and on purpose.
To your knowledge, have any other hospitals in the Gaza Strip been bombed up until this point?
We know that UN relief and refugee stations have been bombed. There was at least one school last week where 18 people, including UN staff and children, were killed in a classroom. That school was holding refugees that were trying to escape the conflict. So we do know that health centers have been hit. We know schools have been hit. We know the access ways in Gaza, from North Gaza to South Gaza, they've been strategically bombed while Israel is telling people to take those pathways.
What are you asking for at this point of the West and UN officials?
You know, at this point, acknowledgement that this is a war crime for the international community and my own country, the United States, which funds a portion of the Israeli military, to no longer turn a blind eye to these crimes, nor the suffering of the Palestinian people. This is a cruel campaign of violence and of revenge. And just, again, any fair-minded person is going to know that Israel, its military, they know where hospitals are located in Gaza. Any denial of that should be met with extreme skepticism.
As you know, President Joe Biden is going to Israel on Wednesday. If you had a chance to speak to him directly, what would you say?
Well, today CARE is joining more than 70 other local, state, and national Muslim, Arab, South Asian, and allied community groups in an open and formal letter to the Biden administration, urging the president to call for an immediate ceasefire as he goes to Israel and Jordan, and to also acknowledge the humanity that is at stake in Gaza and to address the root causes of this violence.
House Robert McCall, Director of Government Affairs for the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He was speaking with viewers Carol Van Dam. U.S. officials say they do not have any confirmation about who is responsible for the airstrike on a hospital in Gaza filled with patients and those trying to shelter from Israeli retaliatory attacks on Hamas. Palestinian officials are blaming Israel for the assault and say hundreds of people have been killed. Israel blames the Islamic Jihad group, saying one of its outbound rockets from Gaza misfired and hit the hospital. More from VOA's Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
At the Pentagon on Tuesday, spokesperson Sabrina Singh, responding to reporters, said the top brass there has repeatedly reiterated to their Israeli counterparts they expect the rule of war to be upheld and that civilians will not be targeted.
We are in constant communication with the Israelis. We are we have seen them, I think, be very deliberate about where they are striking, continuing to target Hamas locations and away from civilians.
Singh added, no preconditions have been placed by the Pentagon on U.S. military aid to Israel, which is waging war on Hamas in Gaza. The Palestinian group, considered a terrorist organization by the United States and other countries, carried out an attack in Israel, killing hundreds of civilians and abducting about 200 people. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
When the Israel-Hamas war began more than a week ago, the only entrance to Gaza was destroyed, and Palestinian workers in Israel couldn't get home. Now, thousands of men are trapped outside the Gaza Strip while their parents, siblings, wives, and children try to survive the bombings in the enclave. VOA's Heather Murdock reports from Ramallah in West Bank.
In this municipal building in Ramallah, a city in the occupied West Bank, hundreds of men spend their days despairing as the war between Israel and Hamas takes an increasing toll on civilians in Gaza. Many say they would rather risk death and go home than hear about their families suffering on the phone or by text message. The men say they don't want to be identified on camera for security reasons. Sela Hassan has a wife and three teenage daughters, all trapped inside Gaza.
We were simple people living our lives. We have nothing to do with what is happening. We were just trying to build our lives and build families. My daughter is in her second year of university and was learning English. She wanted to graduate, but now our dreams are shattered. Everything is destroyed.
Gaza is home to 2 million people, and the only border crossing that was open before the war was destroyed on the first day of fighting, when Hamas conducted a massive surprise attack. Since then, Israel has conducted a near-constant bombing campaign on Gaza. Families have been told to evacuate some areas of Gaza, which is roughly 40 kilometers long and 10 kilometers wide, but there is no way to escape. But Hassan says his family wouldn't go, even if they could.
They say we want to stay in our house until they shell us.
Aid workers say they are providing food and housing for the men, who are among thousands of workers from Gaza whose Israeli work permits were revoked after the start of the war.
Last night there were 800 here. We're giving them food and trying to calm them because they're devastated by news from their families in Gaza.
But supplies are already running low, she says, and there is limited support coming in. Israel has vowed to utterly defeat Hamas in this war, and Hamas has declared it has a plan to defend itself. Many men here say they have given up hope for a happy outcome and believe that they may never see their families again. Heather Murdock, VOA News, Ramallah, West Bank.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 18. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Gunmen killed three people, including two foreign tourists, in a world-famous Ugandan national park, police said on Tuesday, blaming the attack on a notorious militia group. Authorities said the trio were driving through the Queen Elizabeth National Park when they came under attack from the Allied Democratic Forces, the ADF rebel group. The nationalities of the tourists were not immediately clear, but the third victim was identified as a Ugandan. Queen Elizabeth Park shares a border with the Democratic Republic of Congo, and its famous Virunga National Park, a habitat for rare mountain gorillas and where armed groups are believed to operate. the chair of the National Commission, the Elections Commission of Liberia, also known as NEC of Liberia, says she is pleased with the massive turnout of voters on October 10 to cast their ballots for president and the national legislature. David Etta Brown Lansana says, although there have been challenges, including misinformation and threats on social media, the commission is content that it conducted the polls with integrity and credibility and expects the Liberians to accept the results. This, as the commission announced new provisional results on Tuesday, from 98.4% of total polling places showing President George Weah with a slim lead, 43.78%, over his main challenger, former Vice President Joseph Boakai, with 43.49%. Brown Lansana tells me the NEC is working hard and will soon announce the results.
So far, we've done most of the counties, if not all. We have announced results to the effect that just a few polling places are left. And we'd like to believe that in another few days' time, we should be able to announce the final results of these elections. We announced today that we had some issues in Nimba County, where in District 4, ballot boxes were taken away by some persons who the police apprehended later on and retrieved some of those boxes. But when they came, they were all damaged. So today we announced that come Friday this week, we will be conducting elections in District 4, two polling places, elections for the president, the Senate, and the representatives.
These places where you plan to rerun the election, announcing the final results, would that be contingent on you completing the rerun?
The rerun in those areas will go on as we are announcing the results progressively. What we'll obtain is that before we announce final results for the three elections, we will have to complete the election in District 4, Nimba County, in those two polling places for the president, senator, and the representative. Then we can announce the final results. And hopefully by Monday or Tuesday, we may be able to announce the results from there. And then once they go through the tally process, the collation, then of course, we may be able to announce the final results.
So, Madam Chair, let me tell you this question. I've heard it from so many Liberians who think that the process is taking too long.
Yes, everyone is concerned because the expectation is that once you have election today, you should start giving the results today or you should announce the final result tomorrow. But the staff is working assiduously and they have been doing so in the last close to 10 days now, trying to get these results completed. But we should also know that we have internet connectivity issues. Some of these areas are highly remote. So this also takes time because the staff on the field have to look for locations where the internet is much better, is much stronger to send these results. So results being transmitted to us sometimes is intermittently done, but we're working on it and all things remaining constant in a few days' time. The final results will be shared with Liberians.
Madam Chair, I've spoken with some opposition party officials, and they tell me that they are not satisfied with what they see as some government officials showing up at vote tallying centers. Is your commission aware of this?
Let me say that the tally process is open to Liberians, one. Secondly, we expect that party agents will be at these tally centers to corroborate the information received or to tell us that, you know, they're not satisfied with the numbers that they are seeing. We also expect observers in those tally centers. So any Liberian can walk in there, per se. The thing is, everyone should comport themselves not to disrupt the process.
So if I am a candidate, can I just walk into the tallying center?
Like I said to you, you know, people, firstly, we have to identify themselves, and we made sure of that, that you, if you were to come to the tally center. The thing here is because we're looking for the highest transparency of the process, we just need to work people through it and they behave in the way that we expect.
Madam Chair, before I let you go, can you reflect on the electoral process so far, and what do you see as your successes and challenges?
Well, the most pleasing part of the entire electoral process since we started planning some 2 years ago was on the final day, on the elections day, on the 10th of October, for the commission to see the massive numbers of Liberians who turned out to exercise the franchise, that Liberians turned out in very high numbers. So we are pleased about that. Challenge, you know, we've had challenges with misinformation, disinformation, you know, people threatening the commission on social media, not even understanding how the process works. People think that we are cheating, but every time we are telling them that we're doing our best, we have integrity of the process, and where there are challenges, they can become complaints forwarded to the Elections Commission. And then, of course, if the party concerned is not pleased, those cases can be appealed to the hearing office or appealed to the Board of Commissioners and again to the Supreme Court of Liberia. So we think we're good. We think we've conducted a very good process of integrity. We have credibility of all of this, including ourselves. And we expect that Liberians will accept that the process is void of any ideas that some persons may have that we are doing something other than what Liberians have voted for. And we say no to that.
Madam Chair, thank you so much again for the pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James. Good day.
Divehezo Brown-Lansana is the chair of the National Elections Commission of Liberia. She was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Kenya's President William Ruto sought $1 billion more in loans from China on Monday, despite rising public debt that has now reached $70 billion in the Eastern African country, according to the Associated Press. President Ruto was one of several global leaders in Beijing to attend the 10th anniversary meeting of China's Belt and Road Initiative, the ambitious plan that aims to connect Africa, Asia, and Europe through massive infrastructure and energy projects. To find out how important China's Belt and Road Initiative is to Africa, viewers Douglas Mpuga reached political analyst David Monda.
I think it very much has, in two ways, in terms of economic diplomacy, because we've seen a major improvement of African road infrastructure. We've seen an expansion of African railway and port infrastructure, which for many years had been neglected through Chinese support and Chinese aid. But it has also afforded a lot of African countries an alternative source of economic support to the United States and the European Union. In other words, Washington and Brussels are not the only game in town. Africa can turn to Beijing for a lot of its infrastructure and fiscal and monetary support. So it's been successful in terms of that. However, it has raised a lot of its own challenges. Number one is around China's debt diplomacy. A lot of the loans taken for this infrastructure is very unmanageable. A lot of the loans terms have been very opaque, not been transparent. And there's a lot of concern about whether China is actually replacing the old Western nation imperialist model in terms of exploiting resources, just like the colonialists did, just that they're doing it in a different way through heavy debt and these infrastructure networks.
Some people are worried that most of these projects, when African countries fail to repay the debt, the Chinese government takes them over.
Definitely. So there's that case in Sri Lanka when the government there could not service its debts and it had to hand over its ports to the Chinese. But we've also seen, very controversially, more recently, not only the broader questions of debt diplomacy, but also issues of transparency and who these ports are handed to. There's a lot of concern on the continent of Africa because our port infrastructure, for instance, is a strategic asset, not only for imports and exports for the ocean-facing countries, but for the landlocked countries. But more importantly, is a national security asset in terms of a legacy asset for the country. And there are concerns that with China investing in this infrastructure, and African countries are really being marginalized to the competition of major powers, in this case, the United States and China, who are really scrambling for Africa's raw materials, which also leads us to the broader question of to what extent is this infrastructure beneficial to Africans? And is it just being used by major global powers to exploit the continent without any value addition to the exports that are being taken out, without any accountability and investment in infrastructures of governance and norms of human rights, but also in terms of environmental concerns around these infrastructures?
That's David Monda, a political analyst and professor at City University in New York. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Umpuga from New York City. The International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, reports that over 6 months into the armed conflict in Sudan between the army and the paramilitaries of the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, extensive humanitarian needs remain unfulfilled. ICRC spokesperson for Sudan, Adnan Hazam, told my colleague Nabil Biajo that humanitarian efforts are hindered by difficulties in reaching millions of people affected by the conflict.
I think it very much has in two ways, in terms of economic diplomacy, because we've seen a major improvement of African road infrastructure. We've seen an expansion of African railway and port infrastructure, which for many years had been neglected through Chinese support and Chinese aid. But it has also afforded a lot of African countries an alternative source of economic support to the United States and the European Union. In other words, Washington and Brussels are not the only game in town. Africa can turn to Beijing for a lot of its infrastructure and fiscal and monetary support. So it's been successful in terms of that. However, it has raised a lot of its own challenges. Number one is around China's debt diplomacy. A lot of the loans taken for this infrastructure is very unmanageable. A lot of the loans terms have been very opaque, not been transparent. And there's a lot of concern about whether China is actually replacing the old Western...
Sudan is facing devastating humanitarian crisis with a large scale of mass displacement, severe shortage of resources, including food, water, medicines, and fuel. We could say the ongoing fighting has led to the increasing struggling of the people of Sudan, with their needs growing every day. The escalation, and maybe this escalation of violence would only worsen the situation, not just for Sudan, but also for the neighboring countries. And now we are talking over 5.3 million people displaced, either inside the country or seek asylum in the neighboring country. While some found in temporary refugee with a family or friends, many others remain in displaced shelters or camps or makeshift settlements. So this is the situation of most of, let's say, one of the consequences of this humanitarian tragedy, that there is a huge number of displaced people. Months of fighting have left fertile surfaces in the country fragile, especially the water sector and also health sector, making it difficult for the population to have access to these essential services like safe water and health care. So this ongoing fighting also affected the healthcare facilities. We could say there is lack in just in Khartoum, I think just 20% of health facilities still functioning, which is reflecting also the situation of the whole health system in the country. It is affected a lot. There is like a shortage of medication.
That's Adnan Hazam, a CRC spokesperson for Sudan. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biajo from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. And that's it for this Wednesday, October 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.